In essence, what relativity says is that space and time are not absolute, but relative to both the observer and to the thing being observed, and the faster one moves, the more pronounced these effects become. We can never accelerate ourselves to the speed of light, and the harder we try, and faster we go, the more distorted we will become relative to an outside observer. Almost at once, popularizers of science tried to come up with ways to make these concepts accessible to a general audience. One of the more successful attempts, commercially at least, was The ABC of Relativity by the mathematician and philosopher Bertrand Russell. In it, Russell employed an image that has been used many times since. He asked the reader to envision a train 100 yards long, moving at 60% of the speed of light. To someone standing on a platform watching it pass, the train would appear to be only 80 yards long, and everything on it would be similarly compressed. If we could hear the passengers on the train speak, their voices would sound slurred and sluggish, like a record played at too slow a speed, and their movements would appear similarly ponderous. Even the clocks on the train would seem to be running at only 4/5 of their normal speed. However, and here's the thing, people on the train would have no sense of these distortions. To them, everything on the train would seem quite normal. It would be we on the platform who looked weirdly compressed and slowed down. It is all to do, you see, with your position relative to the moving object. This effect actually happens every time you move. Fly across the United States and you will step from the plane a quinzillionth of a second or something younger than those you left behind. Even in walking across the room, you will very slightly alter your own experience of time and space. It has been calculated that a baseball thrown at 100 miles an hour will pick up 0.00000000002 grams of mass on its way to home plate. So the effects of relativity are real and have been measured. The problem is that such changes are much too small to make the tiniest detectable difference to us. But for other things in the universe, light, gravity, the universe itself, these are matters of consequence. So if the ideas of relativity seem weird, it is only because we don't experience these sorts of interactions in normal life. However, to turn to Budanus again, we all commonly encounter other kinds of relativity, for instance, with regard to sound. If you are in a park and someone is playing annoying music, you know that if you move to a more distant spot, the music will seem quieter. That's not because the music is quieter, of course, but simply that your position relative to it has changed. To something too small or sluggish to duplicate this experience, a snail, say, the idea that a boombox could seem to two observers to produce two different volumes of music simultaneously might seem incredible. The most challenging and non-intuitive of all the concepts in the general theory of relativity is the idea that time is part of space. Our instinct is to regard time as eternal, absolute, immutable. Nothing can disturb its steady tick. In fact, according to Einstein, time is variable and ever-changing. It even has shape. It is bound up, inextricably interconnected, in Stephen Hawking's expression, with the three dimensions of space in a curious dimension known as space-time. Space-time is usually explained by asking you to imagine something flat but pliant, a mattress, say, or a sheet of stretched rubber, on which is resting a heavy, round object, such as an iron ball. The weight of the iron ball causes the material in which it is sitting to stretch and sag slightly. This is roughly analogous to the effect that a massive object, such as the sun, the iron ball, has on space-time, the material. It stretches and curves and warps it. Now, if you roll a smaller ball across the sheet, it tries to go in a straight line as required by Newton's laws of motion, but as it nears the massive object and the slope of the sagging fabric, it rolls downward, ineluctably drawn to the more massive object. This is gravity, a product of the bending of space-time. Every object that has mass creates a little depression in the fabric of the cosmos. Thus the universe, as Dennis Overby has put it, is the ultimate sagging mattress. Gravity, on this view, is no longer so much a thing as an outcome, not a force but a byproduct of the warping of space-time, in the words of the physicist Michio Kaku, who goes on, in some sense, gravity does not exist. What moves the planets and stars is the distortion of space and time. Of course, the sagging mattress analogy can take us only so far, because it doesn't incorporate the effect of time. But then our brains can take us only so far, because it is so nearly impossible to envision a dimension comprising three parts space to one part time, all interwoven like the threads in a plaid fabric. At all events, I think we can agree that this was an awfully big thought for a young man staring out the window of a patent office in the capital of Switzerland. Among much else, Einstein's general theory of relativity suggested that the universe must be either expanding or contracting. But Einstein was not a cosmologist, and he accepted the prevailing wisdom that the universe was fixed and eternal. More or less reflexively, he dropped into his equations something called the cosmological constant, which arbitrarily counterbalanced the effects of gravity, serving as a kind of mathematical pause button. Books on the history of science always forgive Einstein this lapse, but it was actually a fairly appalling piece of science, and he knew it. He called it the biggest blunder of my life. Coincidentally, at about the time that Einstein was affixing a cosmological constant to his theory, at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona, an astronomer with a cheerily intergalactic name of Vesto Slipher, who was in fact from Indiana, was taking spectrographic readings of distant stars and discovering that they appeared to be moving away from us. The universe wasn't static. The stars Slipher looked at showed unmistakable signs of a Doppler shift, the same mechanism behind that distinctive stretched-out yee-yum sound cars make as they flash past on a racetrack. The phenomenon also applies to light, and in the case of receding galaxies, it is known as a red shift, because light moving away from us shifts toward the red end of the spectrum, approaching light shifts to blue. The Doppler effect is named for Johann Christian Doppler, an Austrian physicist who first noticed the effect in 1842. Briefly, what happens is that as a moving object approaches a stationary one, its sound waves become bunched up as they cram up against whatever device is receiving them, your ears, say, just as you would expect of anything that is being pushed from behind toward an immobile object. This bunching is perceived by the listener as a kind of pinched and